Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that 8-show a week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is an effect built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to this episode of Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Regular listeners to this podcast will know that I have surfed two careers in my lifetime, one as an actor and one in education. More specifically, in arts education through my role as a drama teacher. Teachers listening would recognise the thrill of the job when we get to see our students surge forth and carve their own path and place in whatever industry they desire. This podcast has given me a terrific opportunity to catch up with former students who are making their considerable impact on stages around the globe in a variety of artistic roles. Nothing delights me more. A gentleman I worked with some 30 years ago is Nick McRoberts. Upon leaving secondary school, he studied piano, composition and conducting at the Melbourne Conservatory, the Victorian College of the Arts, the CNSM in Paris and the École Normale. He studied conducting with Robert Rosen, Jorma Panula and Dijan Savic. Today, Nick is based in France and as a composer, he has completed opera, symphony, ballet, vocal, piano and chamber works. He is presently serving as artistic director of Opera Montmartre in Paris, and his haunting Adagio for Strings was recently released to the world. This beautiful piece of music was written during the COVID lockdowns and recorded with the Janáček Philharmonic. And that was an extract from Adagio for Strings, conducted and composed by Stages' featured guest today, Nick McRoberts. Hello, Nick.
Hello, Pete. Very, very pleased to be talking with you.
Yes, I am. I'm very much pleased also. I think I was calculating before is about 30 years probably since we caught up.
It has been. And it doesn't make either of us feel any younger, but yeah, it's been a long time. It doesn't felt like it, though. It's felt like only a few months since last week caught up. But I think it's, 30 years.
Well, caught up via social media, which, of course, does bring the world closer to together. Mm-hmm. But also, I think, you know, a student-teacher relationship, there's a bond which happens over, you know, 4 or 5 years of being in each other's lives every day. And it doesn't go.
Yeah, no, clearly. And listen, if I accidentally call you Mr. Ayers at any point during this podcast, that will just be a psychological accident. But yeah, as I'm sure you know, the you were one of the several people that allowed me to make the decisions I made finally about going for music, fully going for music, not hedging my bets, doing a bit of law, a bit of medicine or anything else, but really saying, you know what, this is, it's something I love, something I'm passionate about, and it can actually be a focal point of a, I'm not even going to talk about a career, but a life journey. And you were one of a couple of people in that institution. It was called Ballarat and Clarendon College then. I think it's just called Clarendon now, but where it was, you know, possible to dream about and then figure out how to build a life in the arts. So I'm enormously appreciative that you crossed my path.
Oh, that's lovely to hear, Nick. You were very much a sponge, and it was a wonderful education that you embraced there. I was only sort of providing the musical theatre drug for you, but all of your other composition and playing of instruments was done by that wonderful music department headed by Graham Vindy.
Yeah, fantastic music, one-of-a-kind music department. I think if you think about all the people who went through there who are still doing music and all the people who aren't but still love music and participating, that was just a wonderful, wonderful time.
Well, let's talk about Adagio for Strings, which we heard a little bit of just before this conversation commenced, a piece that you have conducted and, of course, composed. Very proud of you. I've listened to it on repeat for a couple of days now. It's a piece which really I find as you're listening to it, it connects with my heart, my heartbeat, and I don't know if you intend something like that, but I just sit there and wallow in it. It's wonderful.
Oh, that's fantastic. Intend would be too strong a word. Aspire, yeah, it's exactly what I wanted to try and do. But writing a piece that actually moves people is harder than it sounds, actually. So yeah, I'm delighted that it connects with you in that way. I've had some nice feedback from other people saying that it moves them, and what I wanted to do was to write something that moves me in different ways at different moments, but not write it in a way that is sort of a strict or didactic, you have to feel this, you have to think this. It's sort of the art that I admire most is where you get something intense from it, something intense, and this is important, intense and beautiful. It's easy to do negative emotions intensely. I'm not so interested in generating intense negative emotions. I think we can do that with the avant-garde stuff pretty easily. But one of the things I admire most about the music that I listen to, the classical, the romantic, impressionist movement, is when there's something incredibly beautiful or soul-destroyingly sad. No, not soul-destroyingly, soul-enhancingly sad. These incredible moments. I often think about that moment, you know, in Madame Butterfly, given the music theatre connection, at the end where she sings and here is my son, and there's this, the bottom drops out of your heart as Sharpless discovers that she has a son. And I'm not quite even sure what that emotion would be called, but it's so intense. And when it's done well in an opera house, you've got, 1,500 people all going, oh, the bottom just dropped out of my heart. So that's the kind of music that really moves me and that I listen to on repeat, as it were, in my own playlists. And so when I was asked to write this piece, I thought, I wonder, I'm going to try to do something that's moving. And I wonder how I'm going to measure up against, it's hard stuff to do.
It's a sorrowful piece. And if you let yourself connect with it, it's really, it's not a sad piece. It's sorrowful. It's actually very fulfilling. Another favorite piece of music is mine, and I hope you don't mind me. No, I'm not comparing it, but a similar experience I have is various themes from Schindler's List, the soundtrack.
Absolutely.
Which is played on a violin. That's not an insult as well.
Definitely not an insult. And I think the recording's actually, it's Zac Pelham, and perhaps plays the theme with an incredibly intense.
He does,
it's not
yes.
Just the theme. It's also all the life that goes into the theme. It's what he's making that theme mean without it meaning anything literal. You know what I mean? There's deep, deep emotion. So, you know, I'm actually, strangely enough, I was taught at the conservatorium to despise John Williams because film music in general, you had to despise. It was lower level music written by hacks to accompany films. I think that's changed a little bit in the last couple of decades. Classical, you know, classically trained conservatory musicians are still snobs, and particularly composers. But I've actually, I ordered only a few years ago some scores, full proper scores from John Williams, not arrangements, and had a look through them, and it blew my mind. The orchestration, I knew it was good, but I didn't realize how detailed. The early Star Wars stuff is, it's as good as early Stravinsky in terms of complexity, part writing, everything else. So, yeah, comparing me to John Williams today, I see that as a huge compliment because he's done things that are both popular and legendary. But actually, if you look in detail, it's not lazy hack work. It's incredibly detailed, crafted, you know, beautiful, multi-layered stuff that orchestras actually love to play. And I saw recently, I was actually deeply moved to see him conducting the Vienna Phil. And they were trying to look po-faced. They were trying to look very serious, like we're being made to play movie music and we shouldn't be enjoying this. But you could see a little smile on the edges of their lips as they played the great themes from Star Wars, because no matter what we've been told to think about film music, when it's great, when it's as good as that stuff, even a really stuffy conservative orchestra like the Vienna Phil end up going, this is awesome. This is just awesome. And they kind of crack a smile, and he's there just beating, very simply beating his music. It reminded me of Richard Strauss, not an inspiring conductor, but the music is so immense that, you know, it's just great. So thank you for the compliment.
Immense and emotive. I don't know if it has been a feature in Europe, but the Sydney Symphony Orchestra had a series of concerts here where they actually played the film and accompanied with the soundtrack. You know, I saw Star Wars, I saw The Godfather, that have these most majestic soundtracks, which orchestras, you know, hearing it live, watching the film is fantastic.
Oh, look, absolutely. And that's really popular here in Europe too. There are a lot of orchestras doing increasingly big parts of movie music in their programs. And I also think that's a sign that we need to... let me say it this way. Those movie music nights tend to be completely sold out. The audiences absolutely love them, whether or not they project a film, when they just play some of the great music from the last 50 years. And I think we contemporary composers need to take that on the chin and try and figure out why some of the best, most moving, most well-crafted music of the last 50 years was written for film and not in conservatories. And take that to heart, because if we can't, you know, increasingly get by performing musical theatres and opera houses and go, well, this is almost opera, so we'll just pinch that. No, musical theatre is its own thing, doesn't need our help. Why are we not creating operas that are as popular as Hamilton? Why is there not a new opera? I mean, Nixon in China is getting a good run, but that's one for the last, you know, now 70 years that we've been trying to produce new operas. And the same in contemporary music. There are a couple of things, you know, there's Steve Reich, Philip Glass, there's Sir Max Richter, there are things that people will refer to, but there's some amazing stuff in film music, and I just love to see our industry, the classical music contemporary industry, go, okay, right, we should actually be comparing ourselves to the stuff that really moves audiences and gets them to come and buy tickets and try and write a bit more of that. So anyway, that was my little bit of political stirring.
Well, you look at composers like Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein, who are great classical musicians and created wonderful symphonies. But, you know, some of their, you know, Copland's Western music also is very evocative, as so is Bernstein, who wrote a lot for the music theatre as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Adagio for Strings, inspiration sought from Samuel Barber and Elgar, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tchaikovsky, the Serenade for Strings. I was actually asked to write a companion piece for that to be played alongside in a concert. I was like, what? Write something that's going to be played before or after Tchaikovsky. I mean, that's just, anyway. So that was one of the things that was in there as well. The other thing that I thought a lot about when I was writing was the Adagietto from the Fifth Symphony by Mahler, that beautiful slow movement that's used in Death in Venice, I think, which also has this incredible, as you said, it's sorrowful without being sad. So those were the sorts of things that were bouncing around in my head. But the trick with all of those is to try and be inspired by the general ambiance, the feeling, but not end up copying or imitating something. And that's an interesting and a fine line to try and walk, to be inspired by, but not derivative of. So
the recording of the piece, it was inspired by your experiences during COVID.
When you recorded it with the orchestra, I believe they were still in masks.
They were. So I've worked a few times, or quite a few times over the last 10 years or so with the Janáček Philharmonic, which is a fantastic professional orchestra in the Czech Republic in Ostrava. I've conducted Debussy, La Mer, Sibelius, lots of different things on different programs. And I had the chance to record with them first time parts of my first opera, which is, my first opera wasn't written for, it's only four singers, but 70 musicians, a choir of 80, it's big forces. Anyway, I had the chance to record with them over a period of about five sessions, that first opera. And so I got to know them also as a composer working with them. And they're marvelous musicians with this wonderful Eastern European string sound that you get in some of those, those orchestras where the strings is just really dark, dark but warm sound. So when I was thinking about, can we record the Adagio and who could we record with, I immediately thought of them, and I got in contact with the orchestra manager to see if that was a possibility. And the fact that it was during the pandemic was interesting, because it was possible, but it was going to be complicated. So complicated meaning getting three PCR tests in 2 days and traveling through Europe was pretty much shut down, walking through airports that were literally empty. It felt like I was on a film set. But then when I got into the room with them, we'd asked for a good sized string ensemble, and they basically brought all the string players of the orchestra, which is why the sound's so big, because this is in March 2021. They hadn't been able to play together since September of the previous year. So when they said, we've got a recording thing, I said, well, I want to do that. So they were actually masked. I wasn't masked because it's pretty much impossible to breathe and conduct enough if you're wearing a mask. And I had to have a test the same morning to be sure that I was negative. But they were all wearing masks. But even behind the mask, you could see that they were kind of deeply moved by the fact of being back together as a group and exploring this new piece and trying to record. But yeah, it was a really, really interesting time. And the whole period of the pandemic, as you'll remember, we went through so many different emotions. So that's, again, something that was going through my mind when I wrote the piece. I mean, there was the first moment where nobody was taking it too seriously. And then we went to sheer terror. My fiance is a doctor. She worked in Paris in the early days of the pandemic in emergency, where people were dying, lots and lots of people, doctors were dying. So we went through that period of terror. And then we went through the period of the lockdowns in Europe, where we were sort of initially all of these different emotions, that frustration, fear, and then boredom. And then what else do you do? What's the meaning of life? So it was really interesting to write the piece and then record it as these different phases went through of the emotion. And then, of course, it sort of seems like it's sort of tapering off and disappearing. But there are all those things going through my mind as I wrote it and then as I recorded it. So we had a great time. We recorded all morning, and the manager came up to me afterwards and he said, wow, what a great piece. It's so sad. I was dripping with sweat from, conducting for 3 hours and trying to get everything just right. But it was really, really lovely, intense moment. It felt like it was suspended in time, the whole experience.
What was your process in writing it?
First thing I did was the kind of research. I listened to the things that I wanted to try and not imitate, not measure myself against, because that would be too arrogant, but the references you need to have really clear in your mind if you're going to try and write something for string orchestra of that type. So the pieces we just talked about, I went through them, I studied them, I looked at them in detail to try to make sure I understood or even understand some of the things about how it actually fits together, the technical things in terms of the string writing, to make sure that I was as prepared as possible. And then put all of that aside and sit down with, I always write at the piano and I do it for a specific reason. I can write also at the table, as they say, just pull out score paper and start writing. But if I do it that way, it's my logical brain that takes over, and I write what I think the music should be logically, harmony, counterpoint. I use my left brain, I think it is, to construct a piece the way I think it should be. And that really, I write really bad music if I write like that. It's predictable, it's formulaic, it's theoretical. So I discovered many years ago that was a disaster to do it like that. And so what I always do, basically, once I've finished preparing, is sit down at the piano without any paper initially, and I just play. Essentially, it's not exactly improvising, because I'm just searching for the first piece, the first musical idea. And so when I find the musical idea, I'm not even sure how to describe it. There's a moment when something comes out of my fingers in the piano and I think, oh, that's interesting. And I might write that down. But then the process is not to collect a few of them and stick them together. It's sort of to try and grab hold. It's like a thread, grab hold of the thread that's connected to that idea and try and pull very delicately that thread to see where it leads. And that's why I write in the style that I do, which is a very sort of neo-romantic, neoclassical style, because that's, in my opinion, what happens. You have these in the really important works, you have an idea, and then the idea goes somewhere very in its own way. The music goes and leads its own and goes in its own direction. So basically, once I've found the first idea, the first question is this the idea for the piece I'm writing, or is it an idea for another piece? And I try and figure out, is this the right one? I pull gently on the idea, and if it's the right idea, then it starts to sort of slowly emerge. And that process is completely instinctive. I spend a lot of time writing down a little bit. I write every morning for about an hour, for anywhere from an hour minimum to 3 hours, depending on the project. I write and I don't sort of second guess myself. I just write down what feels like it's part of the right thread. And then in the afternoon, I export whatever I'm doing on a computer. And I just, at some point when I'm walking around, I listen to it. I listen back without score, without anything. And everything that's wrong about what I did in the morning leaps out to me as I listen back to it. I'm not thinking about what's right or wrong. There are just bits that don't sound right. And the piece is basically finished when there are no bits that don't sound right to my unconscious mind. So it's that kind of process of dipping in, writing something, checking, is it right? And so in this particular, I was surprised that the adagio ends up more or less being in sonata form with a first theme, a second theme, a development section, a recapitulation, but that's not how I built it. I just grabbed hold of a first thread, and when that thread was done, there was another thread which turned out to be the second theme that I just pulled on that one. And I was surprised initially. I fought the second theme. I thought, this is not the right melody for this piece, but it keeps coming back. And I ended up figuring out that the problem with the second theme was in the first version it came to me, it was twice as fast as what it ends up being. So it's like, this doesn't work. I've switched into some other. Anyway, that's the kind of the process of instinctive process of trying to find to touch an idea and then pull on the threads to try and figure out where that leads. If I don't force too much, where the music is trying to go on its own. So, yeah. And that's my process for everything I write. Whenever I'm sitting down, I'm working on the Third Symphony at the moment. So the Third Symphony, there are a couple of things. I mean, the Third Symphony is called the Pathetique. So I listened obviously to Tchaikovsky, to quite a lot more Mahler, to some Beethoven, et cetera. So I listen to my reference pieces so that my orchestrational and compositional brain is fully charged. And then I try to forget all of that and sit down and figure out what comes out when I just sort of let it come out and don't try and push too hard.
I wish the listener could see you as I see you now. You're actually pulling on threads as you are talking, pulling on those threads, which is great. Obviously, composing, it's an oral experience. You're writing for the ear. But do you see anything when you're writing in your mind's eye or any visuals that come up?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, this was really funny. A few years ago, I discovered I have something called synesthesia, which means I see colors in music. And I say it's a funny story because a few years ago I heard about this condition, synesthesia, where the two parts of the brain are too close together, and so you see color associated with music. And the funny part of the story is I thought everybody saw that. I was like 35, wow. And I went, "What? You others don't see?" This is like, no. So, you know, I've ever since now. So I don't have perfect pitch, which is the odd thing about it. But when I think about music, and particularly when I compose, everything from the very moment I touch the first piano, everything has colors, and they're always specific colors. So when I think about anything in music, I see shapes, I see lines, but I see keys in terms of colors, and I see textures in terms of colors. And I just thought we're all like that. Apparently not. Apparently it's a bug, not a feature, but I love it. So yeah, it is a very visual process as well. It's a lot like... I think the difference for me with music, I often, to try and keep myself honest, I think about what would this look like if I were a painter or an author writing a novel. The questions, the big questions about, you know, why you're doing things. And I think the music that I like to write is much closer to painting in a lot of ways than writing, because it's tempting to sort of have a text in a sense, a subtext to your music. But the music that I like the most doesn't have a specific subtext, but has, so that sort of in between the one of the other things that I'm thinking about at the moment is the second movement from Beethoven's seventh symphony. It's the funeral march that starts with a very slow funeral march, and then this fantastic moment where it just modulates into the relative major, and this clarinet melody that soars out of the darkness. It's like, it's not, somebody else described that as being like a sudden light piercing the clouds, a ray of sunlight coming through. And every time I listen to it, I see those images, but I'm pretty sure that's not exactly what Beethoven was thinking. And I'm sure that most other people don't see exactly that, but there's something like that, like Turner or some Monet, where there is a kind of a visual logic as well as an oral logic, because music has to exist over a period of time. So there has to be kind of an arc. There has to be it has to go somewhere. It can't be static. Anyway, sorry, I could go on about this for hours without necessarily making any more sense than I am now.
Oh, no, you're making lots of sense. I love it. Do you ever get periods of writer's block, and how do you deal with that?
So that's a great question, Pete. And as you know, my dad's an author. He's written over 100 books. And I remember when I was still at school, a teenager, I asked him the question about writer's block. And he said, that's a thing for amateurs. Real writers sit down every morning and write whether they like it or not. First rule. Second rule, accept that most of what you write every day is garbage. Third rule, learn to tell the difference and only keep the good stuff. So I've really taken that to heart. Funny thing is, Dad can't remember telling me that specific, giving me that specific advice. But that's what I do. I write every morning, and most of what I write most mornings is not good. Interestingly enough, quite often when I end up writing something I'm going to end up being satisfied with or even really proud of, it's usually on a morning where I didn't feel like writing. And it's usually something I initially didn't really like. There's this kind of interesting, the moment the conscious brain starts to judge what you're doing, it gets it horribly wrong. Some things you think are great turn out not to be, some things you think are not great turn out to be. And so the only solution to writer's block is to write. And the only reason you would be blocked is if you're worried about whether or not what you're about to pen is any good, but that's the wrong question. So I can show it to you, but the listeners won't be able to see it. I've got a beautiful hourglass with white sound. And every morning I come in, fresh cup of coffee, first thing I do in the morning, and I force myself to sit and write or orchestrate, depending on which part I'm in the process, for minimum an hour every morning, whether I like it or not. And so I don't give myself the opportunity to pretend I've got writer's block. I have to write. And sometimes, to answer your question, sometimes there are periods where what I write isn't really very good for days and days or even weeks. But the only way to get through that and get to something that is worth writing is just to keep doing it.
Do we know much about, fellas like Mozart and Beethoven and what their process was? Did they just take a commission and then they delivered it? Or was a daily writing part of their ritual?
Yeah, the various composers, I think, have had very different ways of doing that. Beethoven was one of the... There's a fantastic lecture by Leonard Bernstein talking about Beethoven. I love him as a teacher as well as a conductor and as a composer. But talking about, and Bernstein said this, so this is not me. He says provocatively, Beethoven wasn't really very talented, but boy, did he work hard. And one of the things about Beethoven is that we know from his sketchbooks that he was working on the Fifth Symphony for a period of about 5 years. So he would have these initial ideas, he'd write them down, and he'd go back and go, that's not quite right, I'll rework it. So one of the things that I really admire, I think any successful composer writes multiple hours every day, and that's true of some of the big names in Hollywood too. I was listening to an interview with Thomas Newman saying he writes multiple, up to 6 hours every day, even at this point in his career. So just the art, the craft of writing is absolutely essential, and I think all the really successful ones had that aspect. But the other thing that I think is critical and that I really admire, and it's less known, I mean, there's this myth about Mozart, for example, just writing and it was perfect the first time. It's not true. It's a great story. A lot of things about that wonderful Amadeus movie, a great narrative, but not entirely true. And I often, when I'm starting work on a new piece I haven't conducted by Mozart, I'll look at the manuscript, and the manuscript's full of crossings out, even with Mozart. But it's really very interesting to sort of play through or listen through his first ideas. I mean, and then you go, yeah, I agree, Mozart, it wasn't a good idea to put trombones at the start of the overture of Don Giovanni. That's crossed that line out. So what I'm saying is, the other thing that I admire, producing lots of work, but the key, I think, to the really great ones is this process of being able to to edit, to refine, to throw away things that are, you know, pretty darn good. Because if Mozart writes something, he decides it's not good enough for him, but it might be pretty darn good all the same. But that process of, and my one criticism would be that Wagner, for example, wasn't really good at throwing away the stuff that wasn't excellent. So we end up with these huge long operas. I'm going to say something terribly controversial and say that Tristan and Isolde, which is an opera I love, would be even better if it was a third shorter. But he just didn't seem to be able to do that process of editing and reducing. Whereas Puccini, when he premiered Butterfly at La Scala, it was a disaster. The public didn't like it. And Puccini didn't like it. And he spent 3 more years refining Madame Butterfly after the premiere. Yeah, to make it the masterpiece it is today. So I have an enormous amount of admiration for people like that who are clearly geniuses, but geniuses who don't get stuck with the everything I write is genius stuff and keep trying to refine and improve and fix. So to answer your question, I think most composers had a process where they produce a lot of work, and the really, really amazing ones were also able to sift through that and keep the really great stuff and throw away the stuff that's just not quite there. Nice, but not quite there.
I think Salieri has a line of dialogue in Amadeus where too many notes as a criticism for Mozart. Nick, you're a proponent of the neoclassical style, but you know, your work is still considered controversial by some. Why is that? Is that the music snobbery again, or?
I'm going to try to give that the most charitable interpretation possible. What you're referring to is the fact that my music, which I write for myself and for people who like what I write, and that's all, falls foul sometimes of institutions or individuals who are really strong fans of contemporary music. What most people would consider difficult, atonal, avant-garde contemporary music. I'm surprised that they get so upset, because what I write shouldn't affect anything else. But I've been accused of betraying the side my first encounter with this was in Australia many, many years ago, where I wrote a piece of music, was commissioned for a scholarship. And when it was rehearsed, it was actually, they pulled it, they censored it from the program. And, the person who did that said that we can't let the public hear this music, because if we play a neoclassical piece and we play all this avant-garde plinky plonk the rest of the program, the audience will love that piece and hate the rest. And I thought, that might be the case, but are we not getting the problem wrong if we pull the thing the audience would like in order to keep forcing them to listen to the stuff they're not going to? I mean, this was almost an avowal from him that if they're allowed to listen to stuff they might like, they just rebel against the other stuff. So I think that's what's going on. I think there are people, composers who enjoy, I'm hesitating here because I know some composers of contemporary music who don't even like their own music. They write it because it's the only thing they're supposed to write. Some of the big institutions insist that it be avant-garde, that it have electronic, that this, that, and the other, and they sort of put together pieces in a very, very academic, cerebral way. But I've actually encountered famous composers, names you would know, who think, I don't really want to hear the premiere of this piece. It's not made to be listened to. It's made to look good on paper. It's made for the musicians to enjoy doing difficult things on their instruments. But it's not really made for the audience, and it's not really made for the ear. So there's still a lot of institutions, the case here in France too, where that diehard need to defend modern music and make sure that there's no competition for it, hence the disparaging comments about film music, hence everything else being that audiences might like being criticized as being sort of lower level or lower quality. It was pretty tough the first time that happened to me, because I didn't expect to be getting into a fight, and it had consequences. I literally got censored, things were shut down, things wouldn't be performed. So I was surprised by that. These days I think I have a slightly more indulgent sense that The guy who shut down that first piece, we ended up recording it. And at the end of the recording session, as we were packing up the recording gear, he started whistling the melody from the third movement. And then he realized what he was doing and he looked at me shocked. And I thought, you know, I'm losing today, but I'm not sure I'm going to lose long term if even the people who hate my music the most want to whistle it. So, yeah, it's tricky. But I think slowly the world is changing, because we've had 70 years of being forced to listen to hardcore atonal plinky plonk, and audiences are a bit sick of it now. So if we can just keep writing, or allow music that's not like that, music that's designed for ears and for audiences, to be just performed a little bit more. I'm not saying cancel all of the avant-garde stuff. There's an audience for that. But what about writing some music for the rest of us who'd like something a little bit more, you know, moving, joyful, I don't know, all those sorts of things.
Well, what do you listen to at home to relax and to chill out? You have eclectic tastes with music?
I do, actually. I listen to a huge range of different things. I have some indie pop rock groups that I listen to occasionally when I'm feeling sad. I listen to quite a bit of jazz. I listen to I don't listen to a lot of classical music, and here's why. When I'm studying a piece, I study it in such detail that it's hard to listen to. Like, I listen to it a lot. This is an unstructured answer. Classical music I can't listen to for fun. I listen to either to learn something or to study. I love music, so when I go to a concert, of course I'm there, but when I'm listening to a piece I've conducted, I'm seeing the score at the same time. So there are a whole lot of situations in everyday life where, you know, if I put on classical music, my fiance will tell you this, don't put on classical music I love while driving. My driving skills will diminish immediately because I can't sort of have it as background music. I think that's what I'm trying to say. So I listen to pop, I listen to some jazz. I can listen to those things in other environments where I'm cooking or doing something. If I'm put on opera while cooking, I'll be standing there with a knife in my hand and everything's stopped and I'm just, you know, so I listen to, there's lots of music that I love. There's a series of go-to pieces that I'll listen to in specific circumstances because I just love that emotional jolt. An example is the interludes from Peter Grimes, Britain's Sea Interludes. So the music that plays between the acts of Peter Grimes. And that's just, I could listen to that literally every day. It's extraordinary music with really deep emotions and deep meaning that's not immediately clear. I hear a lot of things in that music, and I think a lot of people do. So there's stuff, music like that I listen to. But what I'm getting to is one of the reasons that I don't listen to a lot of classical music, or romantic music, is that when I'm writing, which is most of the time, occasionally I'll give myself a month or two break when I finish a piece. But when I'm in the process of writing, I hear what I'm working on more or less nonstop in my head. And it's not a voluntary thing, and I'm not sort of the music, that the problem, whichever problem I'm working on, pulling the thread, trying to figure out which is the right thread, it sort of plays permanently in my head, and it plays it's going to sound really silly, it plays very loudly in my head to the point where sometimes it's distracting during conversation, the music that I'm hearing in my head. And I try not to compose late at night because it also messes with my sleep. If you imagine you've got something, you're hearing a symphony very loud in your head at the same time, the temptation to put on some other music and hear both of them at the same time is just not very strong. So basically, whenever I'm composing, I've got noise in my head, interesting noise, musical noise in my head constantly. And the only times that there's silence in my head is when I'm between pieces where I've actually finished orchestrating. And I know that I'm done with a piece when the sound goes off. If I've tried to cheat, and I've tried to take a shortcut in the end and write something that's roughly right, but not quite there, my own brain won't let me off the hook because it'll keep playing the bit where I know I took a shortcut or I cheated. So I need to go back and finish it if I want any peace. Anyway, that's my relationship to listening to music. I've got basically music in my head all the time. I listen to a little bit of music on top of that, either to study or to relax. But yeah, it's nonstop.
Well, this wonderful career of yours, Nick, and vocation all commenced with your first encounter with a piano. Can you tell us about that?
That was at the beach. I think I was about five. We were at Sorrento, actually, at a guest house. And we were on our way to the beach, I think. I'm not sure why we were. My brother and I were exploring the guest house, and I don't know where my brother was. Maybe he's outside in the garden. And I walked into a room where there was all the furniture was covered in white cloths. And there was a particularly funny looking couch. It had a really high back. And I was curious about what it was, really high back and a really, you know, short seat. And so I sort of walked over to try and figure out what this couch was. I pulled up a bit of the sheet because it was a piano, an upright piano. I don't know if I'd seen one before, but I was alone in this room with the lights off and this piano, and I opened the lid and I just completely at random pressed a note, And when I pressed that note, it was kind of like this thing I was describing before, the colors in my mind. It was, I could suddenly, there was, it was like a part of my brain switched on. The very first note I pressed, there was this incredible sort of, it was, I don't know, it was like getting a hit of LSD. And so I pressed other notes, and every note that generated different colors and different things. And that was it. I was just absolutely fascinated from that moment onwards.
LSD, because you're seeing those colors every time you press a note.
Yeah, exactly. It was like watching the start of Fantasia, except that I was five and pressing random keys on a piano, and it just blew my mind. So that's how it all started.
Oh, and then your folks bought you an organ, I believe,
organ. They did, but when we say organ, we're talking about, actually, here it is. So your listeners won't be able to see this, unfortunately, but I brought this back from Australia just this year.
Is that the organ they bought you? Wow.
That's the one. It's a tiny little, and I decided to bring it back because it's a tiny little Yamaha Handy Sound. So it's not an organ. It's a little tiny electric piano with about 20 keys. And this is what I wrote my first 20 pieces on back in the early 80s. So that was, I was like, interestingly enough, it's not a particularly interesting or good instrument. It probably doesn't have any batteries at the moment. But anyway, but the process of trying to assemble sounds and figure out, so I started writing pieces, composing pieces, and then I started writing them down, but I didn't know how to read music. So I had to figure out how to notate. I'd seen music, but nobody had taught me how to read it. So I wrote down some pieces where I had to make up my own system for ledger lines, because I knew there were lines above, but I didn't know what happened when you left the stave. So I just invented my own system for that and wrote down some pieces. And my parents, I think, to their great credit, looked at this and went, oh, there might be something here, vocation and passion. And so they scraped together some money to buy an actual piano a couple of years later. And that was it. You know, that was an old piano, not a particularly good one. But then there was a piano in the house, and I was constantly on the piano, composing, playing, writing stuff. I didn't practice my scales as much as I should have, to the eternal chagrin of many of my piano teachers. I didn't even practice the pieces I was supposed to be practicing a lot. But I spent many, many hours at the piano doing something.
Did your discipline with practice improve? It would have to have.
By the time I was at the con doing my final exams in piano, the quick answer is not really. I think education is wasted on the young, because these days I look at these things completely differently. But at the time, what I used to do was practice intensely just before most of the exams. So I was never quite as prepared or as confident as I could have been, because, you know, it's just, I was cramming at the last minute. So before my last exam at the con, I was literally playing 6 hours a day to make up for the fact that I'd been, talking philosophy and drinking wine the rest of the year, and not I've been living the artistic life, but not doing the work. And only about 5 or 10 years later, I sort of went, oh, I could have done that differently. I should have done that. So these days I'm really disciplined about the approach, so that I can get beyond. And I think actually what really happened is that I started to see, I met an amazing Finnish conductor called Jorma Panula, and that one of the reasons I left Australia and moved to France. He's an incredible conducting teacher. He's taught a generation. He's taught big, huge names like Esa-Pekka Salonen and former students of Panula. And I met him in Australia, and we get along, and he took a shine to me, which was great. But that was my first encounter with the next level of, international. His musical mind is so incredible that I didn't really realize how much more there was to everything I was doing. What I'm saying is, I could kind of fake it and phone it in most of the time. I was okay at piano. I could get by and cram at the end. But when I suddenly encountered somebody who's like a towering living genius, like, give me an example. Panula, I was working with him in a masterclass, and he said, does anybody want to conduct anything? And people looked at him like, you're crazy. There's no orchestra. You just lost the plot. And he said, play anything. And he sat down at the piano and said, what do you want to conduct? And played a Mahler symphony from memory at the piano so that a conducting student could conduct. But he basically has the entire standard repertoire for symphonies in his mind, and he's not a piano player, he's a viola player. So he's sort of seeing the score, reducing it through his mind, and playing it at the piano. That level of, so I realized basically from that moment onward that the next level of preparation, understanding, where just how far classical music could go if you were actually going to take it seriously, and make a career was a heck of a lot further. And so I started to really want to pull my socks up in a big way, study differently, study more, get much more, much deeper. And I'm happy to say today, I don't actually perform very, very often as a pianist these days, but if ever I do, it's intense practice every day to make sure that it's ready. And that sort of transformed my way of working on just about everything.
I have a quote here from an interview you did when you were at Trinity College. I aim to become a professional by the time I'm 30, although that is an ambitious aim. Most conductors take up to their 40th year to accrue sufficient skills. So when did you become professional?
Oh, that's a good question. It's interesting. I didn't remember saying that, but I agree in a sense. One of the things that Panula said is the first 10 years of learning to conduct is learning how not to be a bad conductor. And there are a lot of bad conductors out there. It's one of the questions I get are conductors, do they always serve a useful purpose? And the question is not always, it depends. Some of them are in it for their own glory. Some conductors orchestras hate working with. And that first 10 years of figuring out what you might do with the best possible intentions that's actually not helpful, distracting. He said, don't harm the orchestra. The orchestra can play well without you. And many of the things that you try to do when you're learning to conduct to make them better actually make them play worse. You're trying to over-control, over-manage, control a whole lot of details that you don't control. So your question about becoming a professional, I was still at university, I was conducting in paid engagements where I was paid to conduct. But I don't think that's the measure of professional that's interesting. Are you being paid to do it? If the question is, when do you feel like you're a competent, serious actor in this field. I'm 46 now. I'm in certain repertoire, really at ease in front of the orchestra. I feel like I know exactly what I'm doing and what I need to get from there. But not in all repertoire. And I also think we need to get away from this God complex where conductors feel and think they can do everything, because orchestras disagree. We were talking about it yesterday with a friend of mine here who's principal cello, and he was talking about a good conductor who's good in certain repertoire and awful in other. So I work professionally obviously as a conductor, but I think it's all about not trying to be all things to all people. I like conducting my own music because I know what I want from it. I really love Prokofiev, Debussy, Tchaikovsky, what else? The kind of French or Russian repertoire is stuff that I feel like and I still feel whenever I have to conduct Mozart, particularly Mozart, I feel like I haven't got the maturity, strangely enough. It's pretty straightforward, but nothing worth doing in Mozart is in that straightforwardness. I worked as the assistant to Bruno Weil at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées quite a few years ago now. And I saw him working on, I think it was Hafner, Mozart Hafner Symphony. And that's amazing. The way he is changing the sound, it's not about what he's doing with his hands. It's psychology, it's the jokes he's telling, it's the way he's singing certain lines. Suddenly the orchestra is sounding totally different. And I'm sure I still couldn't do that with Mozart. Hopefully when I'm 60 or 70, I might be a professional conductor in that sense where I can conduct just about anything reasonably well. But I'm really still learning the ropes. There's stuff I can do well at 46. There's stuff that I think if I'm smart, I should say no to because I'm not the best person for the job.
I've seen many conductors in action, and I'm talking about costume now. I'm talking about their wardrobe. Some wear big black smocks, some have a black shirt, some wear tails. When you're at the podium, what's your costume?
I love tails. I love them because they're actually very comfortable. The great thing about tails, particularly when you're conducting, standing on the podium in a symphony concert, is the tails, they allow you to move the part of your body that you're supposed to move, just the upper body, the arms and the head. They hide anything ungainly that you might be doing with the rest of your body, and they sort of incite you not to move. This is one of Jorma's passions, is not to move your feet or your legs unnecessarily, because anytime you move on the podium, the whole orchestra have to slightly shift their gaze to follow you. There's no real reason. I mean, you might jump up and down a little bit and move a little bit, but generally speaking, the stuff that you enjoy doing as a conductor where you walk around the podium is annoying and distracting to the orchestra. So one of the things about tails is it sort of forces the whole bottom half of your body, particularly if you've got really really new patent leather Italian shoes that are so uncomfortable that if you walk around, you basically get blisters during the first movement. So they're sort of, it's kind of nice to have a costume that forces you to not do anything with the bottom half of your body and do everything that you need to do in the classical sense with the top. So I use tails a lot, not in all circumstances, because tails could be overdressed at times. And so sometimes I'll just wear a normal black suit. And sometimes actually doing some really interesting work with Demos, which is an amazing educational project with the Philharmonie here in Paris. And there might be situations where you put on a blue t-shirt with a Demos logo and conducting jeans. I really think again on this topic that the way you dress should really be adapted to the context and the orchestra rather than sort of, so I'm, hopefully you'll never see me wearing some sort of custom designed black smock, because I can't think of when that would be what the orchestra needs. It's a question of fitting in, adapting.
In 2018, you were named artistic director at Opera Montmartre. Tell us about that company.
So Opera Montmartre is a relatively new company, and the idea with Opera Montmartre is to take opera outside the opera house and do things differently. Now, I think just about every opera company wants to do things differently, but if I'm a bit specific, I love opera, and as I said before, there are moments in opera, you may have to sit through 3 hours of music, but there can be this incredible moment of beauty, of culmination. But one of the frustrations I had and I have is that often if I'm talking with friends at a dinner party about opera, they sort of immediately glaze over. There are a lot of people who don't get opera or like opera. And after a few glasses of wine, if you ask them why, they say, it's too long, it's incomprehensible, it's yelling in a foreign language, it's old-fashioned, it's boring. In many circumstances, I can't say that's 100% wrong. So what we're trying to do with Opera Montmartre is figure out how we can adjust and adapt things to present opera, keep all that's great about opera, musically great, dramatically great about opera, but go out to an audience who don't know opera. And my favorite part of our segmentation is the people who think they hate opera and change their minds. And we can't change their minds by telling them they must like it. It's really, we need to change their minds, first of all, by bringing them into, so we have a very large community and an educational process where we bring people who don't know opera into the process to help think about costumes and set design workshops around those things. So it feels like a much more inclusive creative process. And a strong connection also with a community ecosystem around the opera. So it feels like our opera. The idea is Opera Montmartre belongs to the people who are part of it, so that we can do really, really good music, but we can do things a little bit differently. So what we end up doing often is shorter formats. We do things outside in arenas, in summer festivals. We do adaptations of operas. Very, very often we adapt the text. Sometimes we sing in local languages. It's really, the question is, how can we keep the best, the very best, but the very smallest version of what the best in opera is? I'm regularly at the big opera houses in Paris and around Europe to watch and enjoy opera. But Opera Montmartre is about building opera that sort of doesn't try to do the same thing as all of those big opera houses. Tries to get to this different audiences, different audience. So yeah, that's the intent. We kicked off the opera was created in about 2017, so it's really quite young. Very successful in the first few. We started by doing an operetta, actually, La Vie Parisienne by Offenbach. And when I, so as the artistic director, my job is to assemble a team of creatives. I do conduct a little bit, but it's certainly not a vehicle for my conducting. One of the joys I have is to try to find and select creative people who are going to bring something interesting, but something that works. The litmus test is always, will the audience love this the first time? If not, we need to go back to the drawing board. So on La Vie Parisienne, which is very much, can-can, French can-can type Offenbach operetta, I gave it to a director and she read the libretto and said, I'm not directing this. This is misogynist. This is, this is the original text is... And I said, that's fine. And what I want to do is une vie parisienne, so a vie parisienne, not la vie parisienne. I want to do something that connects to Paris today. So I put her with a very, very conservative conductor, great guy, but passionate about Offenbach, who's going to defend the musical text to the death. She wanted to change everything. And then I added an amazing choreographer who comes from hip hop to the mix, because I also wanted it to move differently. One of the problems with opera is it's very static. And I said, listen, I'm going to lock the three of you in a room. I want you to come up with something amazing that the audience loves. I don't mind what that is, but I want the process to be that creative process of friction where it's not just doing something different, that's easy. It's not just doing something strange or odd, that's easy too. Doing something that's different in a meaningful way so that the audience walks away and says that was fantastic. So they did a great job. We sold out in the first performances. We toured to Bulgaria to the State Opera. That same production that we did there won a national award in Bulgaria. And then COVID hit us right in the middle of where we were just starting to really ramp up and do some exciting things. And we've just started to reset and get going again. Starting to reset as of last year with a few new creations and collaboration with Stuttgart. So we're building. Yeah, building more and more productions. But we've got a Traviata this year, Quartetto, which is a creation. Anyway, so we're moving on. It's an exciting project.
Doesn't that sound very exciting indeed? You've come a long way since Rags and Annie Get Your Gun, Nicholas McRoberts.
Thank you.
Congratulations on Adagio for Strings. It's a beautiful piece of music. And listeners can they can download that from, I got my copy on iTunes, but it's on all the streaming services, I guess.
It is indeed, absolutely.
And you have a website too, don't you?
I do. It's just nmcroberts.com. N for Nick, McRoberts, MCROBERTS.com. There's, I think, links to just about everything that's out there on there.
Well, my friend, it's been wonderful catching up. Thank you for this glorious conversation and continued success. It's been an absolute
pleasure. Thank you. It's been great talking to you and I really, really love to catch up.
Well, Paris is one of my favourite cities, so hopefully it's about time I return for the third time.
Fantastic. Let's catch up at a restaurant with a really nice glass of wine or two and it'd be fantastic.
You're on. Okay. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Pete.
Adagio for Strings can be accessed from the various streaming platforms. I got my copy from iTunes. And there is a haunting film clip to accompany the piece, and you can access that on YouTube. And again, Nick's website is nmcroberts.com. That's N for Nick, McRoberts, MCROBERTS.com. It is glorious, and what a treat to investigate the crafts of conducting and composition in this episode with Nick. Thank you and continued success, Nicholas. And hello to Chris, if you're listening. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe. And I'll catch you next time on Stages.